Yeah, I'd go so far as to say technology is never the solution, because there is no the solution. In fact, one of our partners, Dawn Medley, she used to be at Wayne State, now she's at Stony Brook. She always says there's no such thing as a silver bullet, only silver buckshot, which I like. And it's entirely true. I think of us as, actually, we don't drive the outcomes, but we help students make use of all the resources available to them to get the outcomes. Sometimes these are resources that are heretofore underutilized, like supplemental education, for instance. Getting more people to that is going to move the needle a ton. Getting back to the question, you know, what are the conditions? Look, we serve institutions in the whole spectrum, from pretty under-resourced institutions to the folks like Georgia State, who have, you know, the utmost in tech enablement. And you can attack the challenge no matter what someone's maturity level is, but the playbook is a little bit different.
Welcome to Innovating Together, a podcast produced by the University Innovation Alliance. This is a podcast for busy people in higher education who are looking for the best ideas, inspiration, and leaders that will help you improve student success. I'm your host, Bridget Burns. Each week, I partner with a journalist to have a conversation with a sitting college president, chancellor, system leader, or someone in the broader ecosystem who's really an inspiring leader. And the goal is to have a conversation to distill their perspective and their insights gathered from their leadership journey. Our hope is that this is inspiring and gives you something to look forward to each week. Hi, welcome to another episode of Innovation Spotlight. I'm your host, Bridget Burns, with the University Innovation Alliance.
And I'm your co-host, Ian Wilhelm, from the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Innovation Spotlight is a show that is designed to elevate cutting-edge insights and ideas and innovators in the field who can share with us what they're learning from the front lines and be able to give us some inspiration, some perspective, ideally some tips and tricks to make it so that it's a little bit easier to do complicated stuff like innovation. And this is all designed to surface those good ideas in the hopes that they help you in your work. So that's what we call it, Innovation Spotlight.
Later, we're going to hear from Drew Malyatsi, the CEO of Mainstay. But since I've got Bridget here, I do want to ask her a couple questions so we can glean some insights in real time from the field as innovation happens across the campuses in the United States. Bridget, you're working with institutions, you're speaking at institutions as you travel around the country. What is something you can share about innovation right now? What's happening right now, particularly what's going on in the way of innovation at this exact moment that you'd like to elevate for our audience?
Well, it's no surprise when I mentioned that people can't hire folks at the moment. You're seeing that many of the offices that are responsible for doing the project management work of onboarding new technology or doing new interventions, they are completely understaffed. Our work, we have a fiscal sponsor institution. We are experiencing it, but everyone is everywhere. And I can't fully diagnose it as it's entirely that we're ineffective at our transition back to how we do hybrid versus remote versus in-person. I think that a lot of the folks whose jobs could be remote would like them to be, and not all institutions are adopting that same perspective. You're dealing with less people, so it's a little bit bumpier to implement right now. The other piece that's, again, obvious that I see from the outside is how people are spending their time. We're still, in some places, operating in a COVID meeting schedule. The cadence and the timing and the types of conversations that people shifted their calendars to include during COVID, while some institutions, many, have moved away and actually done a revisioning of how they need to spend their time, that's actually not very common across the board. When I talk about this, I see a lot of heads nodding where people are saying, yes, we're still having this one meeting that we came up with in the past few years because we were all remote, but now we're in person. It doesn't make sense. So I would just say what gets in the way is for innovation is how you spend your time. It's your calendar, it's your inbox, it's your phone. Like at the end of the day, I could tell you it's all kinds of other things. We're going to have a conversation about chatbots, about ChatGPT. I want to tell you that the impediments to innovation are super high tech, but it's really, what are you spending your time on? What kinds of conversations are you having on a regular basis? How are you supporting those conversations to be iterative so that you can actually engage in that kind of higher order thinking where you're like, you're generative? That plus the structural project management support issue where people are having a hard time getting vendors paid, they're having a hard time getting contracts through. It feels sometimes like the machine has slowed down. So I would say in general, we're running into the very common rub. It doesn't matter what kind of large organization or company we're talking about. These are very common impediments to innovation. It's down to the people, energy, resources, and whether or not it's difficult to do something new. And it's difficult to do just your normal job. In many places right now, it's difficult to get through the day, difficult to get through the existing workload. And I think there's like a perception that innovation is everyone's job, and so it's no one's job. And I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to have a vice president for innovation or a center for innovation. Just recognize that people are paid to do their job. They're not paid to change their job, and not in their minds, right? Bosses think that, but not in their minds. People that get through the day, I got 40 hours. I also have a family, or I have other things that I want to do with my life. The innovation sometimes can only happen on the margins, or only happens with borrowed time or free time or free labor, frankly. When you have folks who are still on the heels of burnout, you just are dealing with a slowing down of the machine. Now, again, this is not universal, but I would just say these are things that I see fairly consistently. And I think that they are solvable. But the first step is to recognize that these are actually innovation challenges and they are common. Therefore, common solutions can work and everyone doesn't have to struggle to try and invent the wheel.
I remember one specific idea on this idea of too many meetings you suggested, which I tried to implement at the Chronicle, and to be honest with you, failed, was the idea of going on a meeting diet. You suggested the idea that we added so many meetings during the pandemic to actually take all meetings off the schedule for 2 weeks and then come back and say, okay, what did we miss? What conversations were missing that 2 week time? It's a tough thing to do for an organization, but I just thought that was one applicable thing you suggested a while back about trying to find the time and how you're spending your time and just be recognizing, hey, too many meetings can also lead to not enough thinking about new ideas. So what is something, you know, in terms of applied ideas, what's something you are seeing or noticing in the field that's really, you know, making a difference potentially in supporting innovation right now? You mentioned some minutes ago. What are some other sort of specific things you want to suggest and keep suggesting for the field to take notice of?
So I think last time I talked about making sure you have a process or a protocol to support new ideas. Mm-hmm. One of the things I always talk about is using yes and as a framework in your meetings, because you want them to be generative. You want new ideas or babies. They're not there to be judged. And you need to create a space where people are going to pitch and catch ideas. They're trying to riff together. They're trying to make an idea better. And that often requires a level of social safety for imperfection. So yes, and very common from improv, talk about it all the time. One other thing before I go back to it, just what you said is I'm always trying to give people a phrase they can use when they get into the typical meeting where talking about a new thing isn't going to work because there is a story that we are telling ourselves about what is possible and who we are. And if you don't know what the story is, that's the number one problem. Like, you got to at least acknowledge it. My favorite oldie, but a goodie is we tried that already. Or we can't do that here because dot, dot, dot. Usually that's filled in with we're too unionized. The faculty won't like it. You know, you choose any trope. You just have to know what the story is, right? There is an underlying narrative. And if you don't see it and if you don't talk about it, it actually has control over you. The response I really like to whatever the story is, whenever you're trying to talk about a new concept, is say, I know we can't do X. And you have to say, so whatever the idea is. So maybe it's, I know we can't go to common course numbering. I know that we can't centralize advising. I know we can't, whatever it is. I know we can't do it. But if we could, what's one thing we would try? You have to call out the thing that we can't do it, but if we could, and you have to like give people permission to enter an alternate reality that is one where, okay, we've owned that it's not possible. So I'm now going to not think I have to focus on defending my job and protecting the status quo. Because often when people are trying to protect the status quo, what they're doing is like people who say they like change and innovation are liars because you only like the change and innovation that is your idea or that you agree with, right? The idea that all change good is like, that sounds weird. And so you have to actually create social safety because people are completely understandably worried about keeping their jobs, keeping their roles, keeping their office, anything that's about change. You got to create the safety for people to invite them into the alternate reality so that you can benefit from their generative thinking. So that's what I would just say. I know we can't do X, but if we could, what's one thing we could do? And then if that doesn't work, the other option is, what's the worst idea? Try and come up with the worst idea. And as the leader of the meeting, you have to come up with a terrible idea to create social safety first and make vulnerability okay. And so it's like, we could force people. We could, you know, well, we would just physically walk away, you know, whatever the crazy idea is. Come up with bad ideas. That's also a generative thing that I picked up from IDEO. I pick up inspiration from all kinds of places. So the idea of a meeting diet is not unique. I would suggest that if nothing else, you color code your meetings for nutritional value. And for me, the prompt that I have heard and used many times is what things are energy giving versus energy sucking, because energy is the thing that we want. To innovate, you need energy. Look at your calendar and like just which things actually, those are energizing conversations. And these ones are an energy sucker. That doesn't mean you have to get rid of all of them, but you would probably come up with a different strategy to support yourself to make sure that you're able to give great energy for the ones that are going to be the ones that pull energy from you. And you would also perhaps on the after an energizing meeting, you would set aside some time for brainstorming, for writing, for doing stuff. Surf the wave and coast off of the spaces that are energy giving. So those are just a few things that I'm seeing right now. I just came from Nashville and Tampa, and I spoke with, I think there were probably 100 institutions. These are just things that I'm always testing and seeing what is resonating, regardless of the type of institution folks are in.
Today's episode is sponsored by the University Innovation Lab, which is a digital ecosystem designed to help higher ed professionals just like you and I accelerate innovation with a wide array of tools, trainings, resources, and community all in one location. If you also want to drive change and advance student success on your campus, but feel like there aren't enough hours in the day, and frankly, you don't always know where to start, the University Innovation Lab can help. It was created with tools and templates and professional development uniquely generated by the UIA. The lab helps student success administrators and innovators advance student-centered change and improvement more effectively with more clarity, collaboration, and impact. To join our waitlist, go to theuia.org and click the resources page.
Well, I appreciate your points, but yes, and I would say, you know, something at the Chronicle we always talk about is the best way to kill a story in a story meeting is to say, oh, we've done that before, because it does not lead the conversation anywhere and simply shuts down the conversation. So I really appreciate that thinking about the yes and. And I know someone who thinks probably a lot about yes and is our guest today. So Bridget, thank you for your insights. I do want to get over to Drew now. I'm going to introduce Drew Maliazzi, who's the CEO of Mainstay.
Hey, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you. So for folks who don't know what Mainstay is, I will tell you my version, which is it's a company that does a variety of things in terms of equipping campuses and their ability to talk to, but mostly listen to students. And those are called chatbots, but that's not what Mainstay is just. Like, I think you're in general, you're kind of an outside ally for institutions that, again, want to listen more to your students. Tell me how wrong I am.
Great, Bridget. You're hired. Yes, we listen and I think also respond with empathy. Even at 2 a.m. when no one's around to answer a question, we can automate a lot of that. And in fact, infuse it with a ton of emotion science and cognitive science to help people take the next step in their journey. And then maybe the only piece that I love mentioning, but maybe this is only for a subset of the population, is we're the only platform consistently proven to move the needle on enrollment, retention, and academic success. We've done 10 randomized controlled trials in the life of the company, and for some reason, like to expose ourselves to all this scrutiny. So it's a little bit like being on this podcast.
Yeah, you're on the hot seat, even though you're in a very dark room, which like you are actually, we're going to interrogate. Okay, so Mainstay is a company. Many people might have known them as AdmitHub back in the day, and I have given Drew a hard time about changing their name. You are known as the company, the chatbot company that Georgia State works with, and they are kind of exhibit A of an institution that has made investments in technology to improve the experience of students, and they have the data to show that it's worked for them. I want to understand, that's one campus, but not everyone's Georgia State, right? Just like anywhere. I want to understand, following on our earlier conversation about what institutions think about and what they think about themselves and whether it makes them more innovative or not. You've worked with a lot of universities. Is there any advice? Have you looked at some that have been easy to implement a technology from the outside and those where it's been very difficult? Because I know those exist. What kind of advice could you provide? Could you coach institutions on here are the things that really matter if you want to make sure that onboarding a new technology is easier?
That's a great question. There are a few that come to mind. One is don't buy technology, especially AI technology like ours. I always say you should hire it. And I extend the metaphor pretty far, which is, hey, not only are you incorporating this in your team, you're showing all the vulnerability around what's working, what's not at an institution and being really clear about what the goals are and the challenges. But also you're taking a growth mindset with technology and training it constantly, starting small and incorporating it to get little wins and get better every day. Not just get the people better at using the tool, but with AI in particular, the tool itself actually can improve with the right usage. So if you put your best people on it and commit to the care and feeding of a technology like that, it can pay huge dividends. I think you hit the nail on the head with so many people feel that they have so much other stuff to do that they don't have time for just one more thing. But in this case, I would say not just Mainstay, but AI technology in general, this is one special thing that could have breakthrough outcomes for decades to come.
That's super helpful.
In terms of like how those campuses are innovation ready, how do they kind of get ready for implementing that technology? You were kind of approaching it there, but I kind of wonder what do they kind of have to do to make sure that they kind of set the plate and to accept that technology. I just want to hear a little bit more about that, because I think so many people, they think the technology will be the solution, but really it's going to be some of the institutional challenges, institutional silos, things like that, that they have to clear out before they can even, you know, use the technology in a way that actually helps students specifically.
Yeah, I'd go so far as to say technology is never the solution, because there is no the solution. It's only, in fact, one of our partners, Dawn Medley, she used to be at Wayne State, now she's at Stony Brook. She always says there's no such thing as a silver bullet, only silver buckshot, which I like. And it's entirely true. I think of us as actually we don't drive the outcomes, but we help students make use of all the resources available to them to get the outcomes. Sometimes these are resources that are heretofore underutilized, like supplemental education, for instance. Getting more people to that is going to move the needle a ton. Getting back to the question, you know, what are the conditions? Look, we serve institutions in the whole spectrum from, you know, pretty under-resourced institutions to the folks like Georgia State who have, you know, the utmost in tech enablement. And you can attack the challenge no matter what someone's maturity level is, but the playbook is a little bit different. But really, you know, I would say, you know, from a technological standpoint, you want to just have your arms around data so that you can at least share it and access it. But from really a readiness standpoint from people, it's just a willingness to try. It's a yes and, as you said, Bridget. This is a crazy one, but this mindset from, actually, Tim at Georgia State does this better than anyone, is celebrate failure. In a weird way, that's a bit of that growth mindset, which is, hey, when we understand that we are the problem, that is something to celebrate because it means we can be the solution. And that's going to happen with any new technology or really any new innovation you're going to implement. You're going to mess it up. And it's those moments when it differentiates what your success is going to be. And if you can rebound from those issues, you're going to be way more successful in the long run. A growth mindset with technology is going to get you a lot farther than a fixed mindset. And hopefully treating technology partners as true partners, not just vendors.
Yeah.
We're just having you talk about whatever we find interesting today. And I think this whole process of finding the right vendor, this is one that's really important. So people are always asking me, like, who should I, you know, I'm looking for X type of vendor, blah, blah, blah. And that vetting issue, and that's one of the things in the UIA that we do, is because, you know, it's like a vetting and vouching process in our network. We don't let vendors come in and pitch our campuses. Instead, we wait until one of our campuses has good data using a technology or product, and they feel like they want to vouch for the vendor, then they can talk about their experience. And then at that point, that's where that conversation goes. And so that like buffer has been really helpful for my campuses, but it doesn't exist out there. And people have long talked about like a Yelp for EdTech. And there have been attempts by foundations, and there have been attempts by a variety of folks. Even ASU-GSV, I feel like, kind of almost operates like a Yelp for EdTech at times. But it's super difficult to find the right partner and to figure out who's going to be a good fit for you. Are there things that you've observed in terms of questions that you've been asked that have helped a campus suss out whether or not you actually are on the same page or you would be a good partner?
Yeah, and you bring up the Yelp for EdTech. I think it's an interesting idea, but it's about that's like searching for the what. I want Chinese food tonight. I'm going to search on Yelp. But honestly, I think it's more the why and the how in EdTech that makes for the best partnership. Maybe we need like the Tinder or Bumble for EdTech instead, which is really matchmaking, right? It's not about what I'm delivering you. It's about, are we achieving the goals together and are we working together effectively? You know, there are a lot of different ways to skin the cat. There are 1,000 student success strategies and ways to move the needle on retention or graduation rates. Is this the company I want to work with? Are they the right people for us to get the job done? And how are we going to go about doing it? The one I think is actually last in the list. Oh, it happens to be a chatbot or an engagement platform. But really, no technology, even the best technology in the world, is never going to be successful if you're not doing the why and the how properly, which is focusing on the goal and doing the work day in and day out together.
I hope the investors are listening out there for this idea of a tender for ed tech. I want to be on the ground floor of this.
Oh, man, I swear they've tried. Lots of folks have tried. And in fact,
we've tried too. Yeah. Sorry about
people have tried like just an email list, you know, and honestly, it ends up being, I feel like I'm carrying a backpack of experiences and stories from others around when I travel from campus to campus. And I'm trying to remember who else had that same problem. And I remember what the name of the company was. So I would love something scalable. It's just at the end of the day, people trust who they trust and they need somebody to vouch for something. And that's hard to scale.
Bridget GPT.
Well, that's a perfect pivot. Let's talk ChatGPT. Because you, while you are not ChatGPT, you are being asked about this because the closest thing in the market in higher ed is chatbots. And people don't understand the difference between the two. And they are right now very worried about students cheating using ChatGPT. Did I mention that the other day I used ChatGPT to generate a cease and desist letter? And it was awesome. So I highly recommend if you if you need something like that,
don't even need to write an essay.
So Drew, what's ChatGPT? Can you give us the skinny from your perspective as someone who understands the difference between chatbots and ChatGPT?
Yeah, for sure. And for example, chatbots, I mean, are as diverse as apps in your phone. You wouldn't go to Yelp and expect to get an Uber. So there are a million different flavors. ChatGPT is a pretty breakthrough innovation. The GPT is short for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, which is actually derived from a pretty cool paper that came out in 2017 from some researchers at Google called Attention is All You Need, which was really a breakthrough that is now bearing fruit with ChatGPT. Folks might be familiar with DALL-E, which is an image generator, another one for video called Stable Diffusion, another one for voice recognition called Whisper. Basically, these GPT is what's known as a large language model, or LLM for short. And this one is the fourth generation. It comes from a company called OpenAI. And it's really good for answering questions, generating letters, really writing any copy or code, creative writing, and really a ton more. In fact, the technology is even as diverse as being able to understand really any sequence of letters. So genomics or protein folding, these are all derivations of these large language models, which is amazing. If you want to put in the show notes or something like this link to an article by Steve Wolfram last week, he really breaks it down what exactly is happening. But really fundamentally, it's just remembering what it's been fed and predicting what the next word in a sequence is going to be. So it has this giant corpus of text, practically like the whole gosh darn internet, fed into this, you know, meat grinder, and out comes really amazing prose. And simply just by remembering and predicting, it can not only write your letter, Bridget, it can pass a medical licensing exam. It can summarize 1,000-page documents. And this one's unbelievable. It actually scored a 147 on an IQ test, which puts it in the 99.9th percentile of intelligence. And on the other side of the equation, sometimes it hallucinates or downright lies and doesn't know what year it is and blatantly fabricates facts like with utter confidence. And so even the founder of OpenAI, which developed this, said that, you know, this technology is limited but good enough at some things to create a misleading impression of greatness. But he says it's a mistake to rely on it for anything important right now. I think what it's doing is sparking people's imagination of what is going to be coming down the line in the next 10 years. And that is going to be a game changer for society. And I think if we aren't using the same technology to accelerate and improve education, we're missing one, a moral imperative and a massive opportunity for civilization to keep up with the pace of change.
You know, we're
enough people.
I mean, we're hearing so much concern about it. I wonder if you felt like you had a similar arc with the chatbots, that you had to explain it. And is there sort of, you know, new technology comes out, this is very typical, and then especially with AI, and then you have, over time, you see more and more people using it, embracing it. You feel like we're on a similar path with this ChatGPT and other things. Is there an arc that you've experienced as you approach some folks with your chatbots at first, that there was some hesitancy, and then things kind of grew to acceptance over time? Or maybe we're still in that period, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's still some hesitancy, and rightly so, there should be. Bridget, we said in the other podcast, I shouldn't have mentioned that.
No. It was a webinar.
It's a webinar. I think there needs to be like a Hippocratic Oath when it comes to AI and education, honestly, because it's moving so fast and the potential to break stuff. And really, I'm one for creative disruption and destruction, but you know, some of the walls in higher ed are load-bearing, and this could have a huge negative consequences. For us, the way we've always combated the sort of skepticism is by holding ourselves to as much scientific rigor as possible. Are we moving the needle on the things we say we're doing? And are we closing equity gaps? And if we are, like, we're on the right track, but you have to be, you know, relentless about it. I think this one's different, though. And I will say, it's unlike any other technology that's hit the mass market before. Like any technology, the tech is never good or bad. It can be used for good or can be used for bad. So the real key is who's deploying it and how, not the what, but the why and the how again. And I think there is incredible opportunity, but in ways that most people aren't thinking about right now with respect to this technology. I think with this one, most folks are looking at it as like the AI Aristotle, if that makes any sense, like the all-knowing oracle where I can go to this thing and it will give me all the world's knowledge. It knows everything. But the funny thing is with education, rarely is it the most knowledgeable person who makes the best teacher. If you think of the best teacher you ever had, if you were struggling with a math problem, you went to this amazing math teacher, would they just tell you the answer? No, they would ask you a sequence of questions to break down the problem so that you, with your own thinking, can come up with the conclusion yourself. And so actually, I think the greater potential for this technology is not the answers it gives, but the ways that it can help craft questions and follow-ups to students that encourages growth mindset, that has infused with the best cognitive science. And actually, that's how we're planning to use it. We've got these great partners, David Yeager, Mark Brackett at the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, Dave Yeager at UT Austin, and a whole host of other collaborators that are helping us train this so that we can elevate the conversation between students and teachers. That, I think, has far greater potential than has this, like, the chat replacement for Google or chat replacement for Wikipedia.
This, I feel like people got a little bit of education about ChatGPT. They got a taste of what chatbots are about. I do want to ask if you can clarify the high level, the risks of AI and chatbots on campuses. You kind of touched on that a little bit, but I would combine that with how specifically Mainstay, what kinds of guardrails? You said that, yes, holding yourself to that higher level of rigor, but people should ask these questions of ed tech companies to ensure they have taken the same Hippocratic Oath. And those questions are...
Look, I don't know what the questions are for everyone, but because honestly, every university is different, so they should ask their own questions. But I think fundamentally you should ask, hey, does it work? Do you have references that say it delivers what you claim it delivers? And tell us how we're going to do it. Because I don't even want to know just that it works. I want to know how we're going to do it. And how you did it with Georgia State is not how we're going to do it at, you know, Podunk State. We're a different school and we've got a different student body, and let's tell you our problems and have you fall in love with them just like we have, so that we can solve them together. You know, I think it's probably more, rather than the Tinder, like, do we love each other, but do we love the same problems? And if that's the case, that's probably a good indicator of a partnership. What was the first part of that question, Bridget? I think it was a two-part.
Well, about the risks of AI and chatbots, but I would just add, if you're talking to fancy EDU, instead of podunk. One of the questions I would also arm you with is, what were the conditions that were necessary on the university side of the house to ensure that this was a great partnership? And hearing that from the actual companies to know, okay, well, they actually give us a project manager. They actually had us report it. The person who signed the contract was the vice president or whatever. Those little conditions, those matter a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the highest levels of leadership need to be bought in and stay informed. They don't need to do anything, but at least on a quarterly basis, checking in, understanding, is this aligned to my goals? I don't know if you've seen this, Bridget, but one of the things I've noticed in higher ed is not all levels of the organization actually know what the goals of the institution are. You know, someone at the lowest level probably doesn't actually fully recognize, hey, what are our enrollment goals? Do we have something? And it's the best universities that are able to share those goals at all levels and have everyone marching toward them. To some degree, actually, vendors can be a great help because they can be their justification for creating that level of transparency up and down the organization to say, hey, you might be 26 years old and a new hire in this office, but you've got to know that we're running in this direction and this is how we're measuring. And this is what I'm on the hook for as your leader. So I think that's one handy way to make sure that just everyone's aligned to the same goals. You asked about the risk, though. I think there's some obvious risks around, you know, obviously any technology and making sure that it's, say, answering their questions, et cetera. But there's a hidden risk with this particular one, which is the biggest risk is that you put it in a corner of your website and just think that you're done. Because it'll work just fine on the corner of your website. But if you're not constantly advancing it and weaving it, and this goes for many technologies, weaving it into the fabric of how you operate, you're going to miss massive opportunities. So if you're thinking it only as, hey, this is going to make me a little bit more efficient answering student questions, you're going to miss the massive opportunity to move the needle on student outcomes and do that consistently. And the ones that we've had the most success with, you know, they celebrate the win. Hey, Tim, you helped us drop summer melt by 21%. Let's do it for year-to-year retention. Okay, great. We increased year-to-year retention 3 percentage points. That's awesome. Can we move the needle for large lecture classes with high DFW rates? Like, okay, great. We moved the needle for that large lecture course. Can we do it for the STEM courses too? Can we do it at the community college level? You know, and the question is like, who is always willing to take the next step with you? It's really, those are my favorite partners because they're the fuel for innovation, not us. Like I don't come up with the ideas. Tim does, or Don, or, you know, Michael Berman, or whoever else or Ashir. And they call us and say, I imagine like if a technology could do this for me, that would be amazing. And those are the best partners.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you, Drew from Mainstay, for sharing with us your insights from ChatGPT, connecting with institutions trying to actually implement an outside technology. The question that I think is probably the most important, though, for our listeners is, Drew, who's your dad?
Oh, geez, Bridget. You said you're going to. My dad and uncle were the co-hosts of a radio show called Car Talk for 37 years or so.
Actually, I have gotten to meet his dad. I've gotten to meet Ray from Car Talk, and I still think the coolest thing would be getting him to do my outgoing voicemail message because that voice is super iconic. Whenever I tell people this, they're like, and Drew is always bashful about it, but I'm like, man, you should lean into that because that was my generation. I grew up listening to Car Talk. Anyway, that's your fun fact for the day is that your chatbot might be somehow in some way connected to the show Car Talk.
We've squandered another 35 minutes. today.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciated your time. And Ian, as always, excellent to have you as my co-host. And for those of you at home, we're looking for suggestions for who are innovators in the field advancing important work that you'd like us to interview to learn about the experience of innovation, advice for innovation, and what kinds of things that folks should be considering and doing. So we are happy to hear from you in our DMs on Twitter. And otherwise, we hope you have a wonderful week ahead.